Deborah's home was stolen. Now, I don't mean thieves stole stuff. I mean scammers literally stole her home. The FBI calls title theft one of the fastest growing white-collar crimes. And this story is why you need Home Title Lock. Deborah says, criminals found the title to our home online and filed fraudulent documents claiming they owned our home. Wait, it gets worse. Deborah goes on to say, I was evicted from my own home and $85,000 in equity, gone. Nobody believes you can get your home stolen this easily. This is why you need Home Title Lock, because no insurance or bank protects your home from title theft. First things first, go to HomeTitleLock.com and register your address to see if your home's title has been tampered with. You need to protect the legal title to your home so you don't end up like Deborah. Go to HomeTitleLock.com now for 60 risk-free days of protection. Again, that's HomeTitleLock.com. HomeTitleLock.com.
Welcome to Amped Up with Proud Resister. This is progressive activist Ryan Knight.
And I'm Chris Lavoie of the Stephanie Miller Show.
And we have two guests today.
Holy cow.
We've got a big show.
Yeah, we do.
We have Mitch Weiss. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist with the Associated Press. And we have Holbrook Moore, who is also an award-winning investigative journalist with the Associated Press. And they are here today to talk about their new book, Broken Faith, Inside the Word of Faith Fellowship, one of America's most dangerous cults.
Ooh, okay.
Welcome to the show, you guys.
Hey, thank you for having us.
Yeah, look, you know, with our politics becoming so tribal right now, particularly, you know, after the election of Donald Trump, I think this book is coming out at the perfect time. You know, I just started reading it. I'm like 100 pages in and I can't put it down. I was actually reading it this morning when I woke up. But I want to start off the show and just, you know, what inspired you guys to write this book? And how long did you spend investigating the Word of Faith Fellowship?
You know, to be honest, it really started about 8 years ago. I know that's a long time. Both Holbrook and I do investigative journalism for the Associated Press. We're on the national investigative team. And the one thing we always do is we always look for stories. Mm. And we also always listen to people who call us. We have a lot of sources all over the country, and we listen to people who call in with tips. And this really started with a tip. There was a group called Faith in America. And what the group did was they advocated for religious, you know, freedom. There were so many churches around the country that were discriminating against, you know, gays and and it was just a group that found this kid who was, they said, was abused by this church called Word of Faith Fellowship. And I knew nothing about Word of Faith Fellowship at the time, but I decided I was going to go up there and talk to this young man. His name is Michael Lowry. And I went up and I interviewed him, and he told me this story about this church that believed that people are infected with demons. Everything in their life that goes bad is because of a demon. If you're gay, it's because you have the gay demon. If you're an alcoholic, it's because you have the alcoholic demon. Mm. And the way to get rid of these demons is by blasting. And blasting means you surround someone and you shout, come out, devil, come out. And in its most violent form, you hold them down, you beat them, you hit them to literally beat the devils out of them.
Right.
And so in his case, they believed that, you know, he was gay, and they decided they were going to get rid of his, quote, homosexual demons.
Wow.
And that was the story he told me. And so that's really where the investigation began in October 2012, but it took a turn. As I started looking into the church, and again, I knew nothing about the church at the time, about a few weeks after I interviewed Michael Lowry, I got a call from one of the leaders of Faith in America and said, Michael Lowry is missing. Now, you have to understand he was a young man, early 20s, and his parents, he was actually born into this cult. So he didn't know anything about life outside, you know, the church's walls.
Right.
And so there was a fear that maybe he might have committed suicide because it was all too much. You know, imagine you're sheltered your whole life from pop culture, from music, and all of a sudden,
cut off from the entire world.
Exactly. And so I went up there. I said, look, I'll help you guys look for him because I was worried. And I went to his parents' house, knocked on the door, and they looked at me like I was from Mars. They said, look, you know, he's not here, but you need to talk to someone at the church. Now, at the time, I didn't know much about the church, that essentially it's almost like a compound where they have armed guards and it's private and you have to be invited in. But, you know, I got in my car and I went over to the church and I walked up to the front desk. And before I went in, there was somebody I knew who knew Jane Whaley. And I asked him, I said, can I drop your name if, you know, I go in the church and maybe that'll be a way for me to talk to her. And Jane is the leader of the church. And he said, go ahead. So I managed to get in the front door. I dropped my friend's name. And a few minutes later, Jane Whaley was there. You know, she was a small woman with big blonde hair, with, you know, lots of jewelry, dressed really nice. She looked like, you know, a Southern, you know, grandmother. And, you know, she asked me a couple of questions. How did I know my friend, the name that I dropped? And then she gave me a tour of the church. She took me to some of the classrooms. And then she took me to a part of the church where they have what they call the Holocaust Museum. And essentially, it's a place where they have artifacts from the Holocaust. And the reason is, as she explained, was that her church, she believed, had been persecuted by DSS. And she equated her persecution with the persecution of the Jews by the Nazis.
Wow.
So what she did, I'm not making this up.
No, now. I know. I'm just,
I think one reason she took me there was because she believed that I was Jewish, and I am. And she figured that, well, if I show him the Holocaust Museum, then how could he think that I'm such a bad person if I have all these exhibits and artifacts?
Right.
And, you know, I recognized a lot of the things. They were replicas of iconic photos, you know, kids with their faces pressed against the barbed wire, mm-hmm. the shoes, the hair. But there were also other artifacts in there as well, like, you know, a wood model of scale of the Warsaw Ghetto, you know, where you had the uprising in the summer of 1943. And then at the end of the tour, she said, why are you here? What can I do for you? And I said, well, I'm looking for Michael Lowry. Do you know where he is? And she said, he's in the basement.
Oh.
And, you know, my first reaction is, okay, at least he's alive. And I asked her, well, can I interview him? And she said, yes, under one condition. I have to be there, the church's lawyers have to be there, and Michael Lowry's parents have to be there as well. So I agreed to it, wow. And a few minutes later, they brought Michael Lowry up to one of the church's offices, and I immediately noticed this was a different kid. This was somebody who, you know, when I had talked to him before and I saw him, he was outgoing, he was a little shy, but he was bubbly, he loved being on the outside. But the Michael Lowry, he was sitting on that couch that day, you could tell that he seemed drugged out, which I would later find out he was. But his eyes were glassy. He was slurring his words. So the first thing I said to him was, Michael, if you want to leave, you can walk out the front door with me right now if you're being held against your will. Of course, I didn't know then that if he had taken me up on my offer, the security guards would have jumped on me. But, you know, I made him that offer because I felt like he was being held against his will. And he said he wasn't. And he went into a story about how he lied about the church and they really don't abuse people. And, you know, he left the church and made up all the lies because he was addicted to pornography and his parents were going to kick him out. And so at that point, he recanted. And, you know, we really couldn't do anything. We couldn't drill down deeper because it there were too many red flags, and we had to take a step back. But the one thing that drove us was, you know, remembering the look on his face that I just didn't feel like he was telling me the truth sitting surrounded by, you know, his family and Jane. So now fast forward, I kept in contact with the advocates. I talked to Holbrook about what was going on, and I told the advocates, people who were working with cult members who were trying to leave, that if anything happened, to give me a call. And in December of 2014, they did. They said that five members of this church were indicted for kidnapping and assault for beating another gay young man because they were, quote, trying to beat out his homosexual devils. And they beat him. It was unbelievable for a couple of hours. They beat him so badly that he urinated in his pants. He thought he was going to die. And so, you know, I talked to this young man. His name is Matthew Fenner. And Matthew told me a story about how he spent almost 2 years trying to get law enforcement, trying to get anybody to look into the church, to look into his allegations. And finally, you know, they the district attorney brought the case to a grand jury, and, you know, you had these five members who were indicted. So at that point, I went to my editors and said, we have to revisit.
We have a story here.
Exactly.
Right.
And then, you know, Holbrook and I, we made a list of who we had to call, and boom. And for a couple of months, we found out that people just didn't want to talk. They were too scared of Jane Whaley, too scared because they had family members inside, and they would be separated from them if they talked.
I want to just give our listeners a kind of so they know who Jane Whaley is, right? Jane Whaley is the founder of this cult. She believes that she's a prophet who holds the key to eternal salvation, and she controls all aspects of her congregates' lives, from where they live, whom they can marry, and even when they can have sex. I couldn't believe when I read that. You know, one thing I just to kind of shift the conversation really quick here, we often hear that leaders of these cults display certain characteristics, right? In your research, what were the characteristics, or what are the characteristics of Jane Whaley that make her such a dangerous cult leader?
Well, she has a very dynamic and charismatic personality. She knows how to read people and see what they need. For example, there's one family, the Coopers, we talk about in the book. At one point, they wanted to get out of there. They didn't believe what they were being taught anymore, so they decided to leave. Well, Jane got wind of it, and she made them leaders in the church. So now, all of a sudden, you know, they're walking out on in the sanctuary with her. She's the rock star there, and now they're part of the entourage. So she knew that they were looking for something, and she found it. And it kept them there for years longer.
So it's like that manipulation.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, and one of the things, and this is one of the characteristics you find with cult leaders, is they get you to confess to your deepest, darkest thoughts. And then, and Jane did that, and she kept everything written on index cards. And she would use it against you. So if you even thought that you were going to leave, she would pull out that card. And, you know, so it went deeper than that, because she, you know, knew that in order to keep people in there, she had to separate, you know, family members. So she started taking the kids from families and having them be raised by ministers. She cut, you know, all the members off from the outside world. There was no radio, TV, newspapers. You know, they worked for companies owned by, you know, the church leaders. So you become isolated from the whole world. Your economic well-being is, you know, based on the church. You're totally tied to the church. So it becomes that much more difficult to leave.
Right.
And one other thing about Jane that I think is really important. When you think of cult leaders, you think of mostly males.
Yep.
You think of Jim Jones or David Koresh. This is a woman, and all of her chief ministers are all women. And so the other thing is that, you know, with a lot of cults, you hear about cult leaders and sex, and here, this is almost like the anti-cult in a way, because she preaches sex is bad. You're not allowed to have sex. And that, you know, because you're giving into the unclean, the lustful devils. So she regulates everything from married couples to, you know, newlyweds. You can only have sex when ministers tell you you can. And then there are, you know, conditions, you know, rules, like it can't last longer than 30 minutes. It can only be missionary position. You know, it goes on and on and on.
You know, one of the first questions I had when I started reading the book, and the book is so compelling and just riveting, is why people didn't just get up and leave when the abuse started. You know, I understand there was a great deal of fear of leaving the church. They would tell people that no one in the outside world loves you and your only path to heaven is remaining here. There are also instances of people being physically held back from leaving the church or chased through the woods. Do you want to talk a little bit about the fear and the control that Jane Whaley wielded over her congregants that prevented them from leaving?
There were a couple of things. People truly believed when she told them, if you leave here, you'll become an alcoholic or a drug addict, or you'll get cancer, you'll die. They really believed these things. And even when people overcame those fears, often it would be they would be faced with a choice like this guy in the book, John Huddle. He wanted to leave. His wife and kids didn't. So he left, and they stopped communicating with him. The guy has never met his grandchildren.
Wow.
And those are real fears, and that happened with numerous families. And like Mitch said earlier, what would happen is these families would be split up, and one kid sent to live with this minister for a while and another sent to live with this minister. And sometimes the kids became more close to the ministers than their own parents. Mm-hmm. So if the parents wanted to leave, you know that, again, you're faced with that decision. Do I leave my family here?
Yeah. You know, one of the most disturbing parts, too, was learning about the physical abuse that went on at the Word of Faith Fellowship through a practice known as blasting. And you talked about that a little bit earlier, Mitch. Do you want to explain, though, just, you know, go into a little bit more detail? Because from what I'm also aware of, that they actually used blasting against children as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's what makes her church different, is that she believes that literally you have devils, and the only way those devils will leave you is if, you know, you blast them. And it starts with a group of people who surround you, and they start screaming, "Devils, come out, devils, come out." And if that doesn't work, they hold you down and they beat you. And in the church, it became more abusive with time. So at the very beginning, the beatings weren't as bad. It was mostly surrounding people and, you know, restraining them. But over time, it became more and more violent, where, the beatings could last for hours, where they would keep punching you and, you know, choking you and restraining you until they believed that the devils were out. And, you know, with babies, it's a perfect example. So let's say a baby is crying. They don't believe the baby is crying because the baby is hungry or the baby has a dirty diaper. They believe that the baby has a devil. And so groups of people would surround, and I will surround, because this, I want everyone to know this is still going on. Mm. They would surround the babies and start screaming at the top of their lungs, "Devils, come out." And I'm just thinking, okay, like I want people out there to imagine if you have a child or if you have a grandchild. Imagine that one-year-old. And what would you do if you saw 10, 12, 15 people surrounding that little infant, screaming and yelling? I mean, it's that image is so disturbing.
Yeah.
And it stays seared in your memory. I mean, we have people that we talked to, and we talked to more than 100 former members, that, you know, that's the thing they remember the most. That's the earliest memories of the church, people just constantly yelling and screaming when they're toddlers.
Well, you know, and the question that keeps going on in my mind, and I know there were some investigations, but, like, why hasn't law enforcement taken real action to protect these children and families who are being abused by this church? You know, so often in our society, the power structures and institutions that are supposed to protect us fail us. And oftentimes they fail because instead of protecting the most vulnerable among us, they are protecting the privileged and the powerful. Is that what is happening with the Word of Faith Fellowship?
You have several things that have gone on over the years. Years ago, the Department of Social Services opened up an investigation into the church. The church hired a powerful New York law firm, and they fought, and they've got money to fight. And eventually, the Department of Social Services buckled and actually changed the way that they would investigate members of the Word of Faith Fellowship. Word of Faith Fellowship members are trained or coached on how to lie to authorities. One good example is, you know, Matthew Finner, the gay man who says he was beaten for them to expel his homosexual demons. When that case came before a grand jury, his own mother lied at the church. Now, she has since left the church, and they have reconciled, but those are the kind of things they would do. And, you know, Mitch sat down with a former prosecutor there, and he said he just got tired because you have these people, they, you know, they circle the wagons to take up for one another. They come into court. They're dressed to the nines, as he said. He basically, they just wore him down.
Mm.
Right, and that's really disturbing because the institutions are there to protect people, right? As you mentioned, the most vulnerable. And in this case, they totally failed, from the local police to the state police to federal they all failed these people. Mm. And in part because of the money, you know, this is a poor county, and, you know, Word of Faith Fellowship and Jane Whaley have a ton of money. They're, you know, they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're pilots.
I was going to ask, how did they get all their money? But like you said,
they're professionals.
Yeah, okay.
They're professionals. So, for example, one of the people that we follow in the book is, Rick Cooper, who's the patriarch. He spent 20 years, as an engineer on a nuclear submarine in the U.S. Navy. So all these people are well-spoken, well-dressed. They have money coming in. Mm-hmm. There's a guy there who was in the church. He's since passed away. But he was a doctor who attended Duke University and treated, President Kennedy back in the 60s. So these are prominent people now.
Right. And that's what's so dangerous, right? Yeah. Because on the outside, they make it's like this big facade, right? Where it looks from the outside, like, look at these people. They're successful. They're
well read.
They've got it all going on.
Yeah.
And then, but little do you know what's really happening, behind the scenes, So it's like, it's like this big illusion, right? That people can't figure out what's really going on there.
And it was a slow, gradual thing. You know, it's not like when the Coopers joined the church, they said, okay, guys, come on in, but we're going to strip you of all your freedoms and you can't leave.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
You know, they were showered with love. And Jane Whaley is like this grandmotherly figure. And all the people have nice cars and nice homes. And the church is beautiful. And they're seduced. And then over time, Jane Whaley comes up with these edicts. She says, okay, birthdays are a pagan holiday. We're not celebrating birthdays anymore. Christmas is a birthday. We're not celebrating Christmas. Give up your TVs. Don't read magazines. Don't listen to the radio.
Yeah.
So it was over time these things happened. And by the time it got really extreme, people believed that God was telling them, this is the right thing.
Right.
And that was one of the most challenging things when we would try to talk to people who are currently in the church. They would always say, we've never seen any abuse in the church. And even if they've seen this blasting, they don't consider it abuse, because how can it be abuse if it's what God wants?
Right. Well, when you say, they cut off the radio and they cut off the TVs, that is a classic, gaslighting maneuver for a lot of these cult leaders, because if you cut off all other information, then the cult leader is the only source of information, right? So you get it to where they're only listening to the person, to that one person, and then that person can manipulate and control them.
Oh, absolutely. I have to say this, Ryan, this story, and Holbrook and I have covered, just about every kind of story. I've done every kind of investigation, but this one and really bothers us it more than anything else I think that we've ever done, in part because of the kids and the abuse continues, and the authorities have the power to stop it looking the other way. They are just so well connected that the authorities up there are afraid to go against them. And then you hear these stories from the victims being isolated, from their parents. I mean, there was this case of these five kids, and their only crime was that every once in a while they would smile at each other in class. And for that, they were beaten, separated from their families. They weren't allowed to go to school. They had to sit in a room for a year straight watching Jane Whaley videos. Mm. That was their school, because they run this Christian school up there. And it goes on and on. The psychological damage that has been done, the physical damage, is just unbelievable. And it continues. So it's not like we're talking about, Jim Jones or Dave. That's in the past. This is going on now.
Right,
and
actively.
That's what makes it so relevant.
When you talk about the kid who is gay, this really hits home to me, because I grew up gay in the church, and in the Catholic Church. And, I wasn't physically abused, but you know, growing up in my conservative, you know, Catholic family, you know, I was not accepted for who I was. And, you know, I'll never forget the moment where I kind of found out I was gay and I kind of came out, and it was like the entire, my entire belief system up to that point, my family, everyone who I thought would love and protect me said no. Like, this is, you know, we're not going to accept this. And that, you know, my journey in and of itself without the physical abuse was hard enough. You know, it took me a good 10 years just to heal and learn to love myself, and to finally now I have a great relationship with my mom and my dad and my family. But I can't even imagine what, you know, what the LGBTQ kids in this church are going through, because, you know, I had people to talk to. I had counselors I could go see. I could go to the LGBTQ center, you know, in my city, you know, and I had resources, you know, and people that would help me so I could learn to love myself. But to hear that there's, you know, again, the most vulnerable among us, that there are LGBTQ kids in here, and that they are, you know, equating who they are to having a demon and they're beating them. I mean, it affects me deeply, and I think it will affect a lot of our listeners on just such a deep level.
Let me tell you this story that you'll get to in the book about Matthew Finner. One of the reasons Matthew Finner's family joined the church was because his mother knew he was gay, and she thought the church could help him, you know, basically overcome being gay. Mm-hmm. So they joined. It couldn't be known in the church that he was gay, and in the church, they pair couples together. So this is a really sad story that's in the book. They paired Matthew with this young lady named Danielle Cordes. And, you know, to her growing up, she grew up in this church. Matthew was kind, and he knew about the outside world, so that intrigued her. And basically, she fell in love with him. Mm. And think about the emotional damage these things do to people.
Yeah.
She tried to protect him when he was beaten. And you have to remember, that was January 2013. And Matthew comes across. He eventually helped Danielle escape, but he comes across as sort of a hero in the book because he was going to fight for justice no matter what. When he didn't get answers, he started started secretly recording conversations with the sheriff or the district attorney. That way he could say, look, you're blaming him for not doing anything, and he's blaming you. We got to get something done. So like Mitch said earlier, it was 2 years before these five people were charged. Only one went to trial, Brooke Covington, who's one of Jane Whaley's top leaders. But in the middle of the trial, or in jury deliberation, a juror brought unauthorized documents, so there ended up being a mistrial. That was in 2017. So he continued to push for justice, and we're told now that, you know, in the next few months, these five people may finally face trial after 7 years.
Wow.
It's and what's wonderful about Matthew is an incredible guy. We love him, and he has been fighting so hard. But while he was in the church, he fell in love with another congregant. This kid, his name is Patrick, and so they basically, you know, was their first kind of romance crush, mm-hmm. and they also targeted, you know, Patrick as well, and beat it was just horrific what they did. If they suspected, you know, you were gay, that they went ballistic, and the beatings just lasted longer.
Right, which makes this a hate crime, essentially. You know, this church is committing hate crimes.
Well, here's the thing, and this is really important, and this is why I wish that, and I am so glad that we're on your show, because we really want to get the word out. It's not about the book. It's really about the victims.
Yeah,
and what
it's about these stories and these lives.
But here's you mentioned something that I got to bring it up. So we mentioned that, you know, Matthew fought for justice. So he would go around to all these officials telling his story, like, we need to charge these people. And of course, you know, they didn't want to do anything because the church was powerfully connected. Mm-hmm. So one day, Matthew and three of these advocates, they meet with an assistant U.S. attorney, okay? And they go in, they manage to get a meeting with her. And in the meeting, Matthew says, this is a hate crime, okay?
Yep.
Can't you charge them with it? And you know what the assistant U.S. attorney said? Well, those cases are really too hard, and so I don't think we're going to go that route. And we have her on tape saying it. And so you're listening. Wait a second. There's a federal law that bans hate crimes, especially against the gay community. I, we don't get it. We don't understand how someone could just casually dismiss, well, you know, they're just too hard to prosecute. Well, you know what? Do your damn job.
Yes.
Prosecute the case or get the hell out.
Yep.
And that's what bothers us more than anything else, the excuses that the institutions made. And so that's why when we're talking to you, it's not so much about writing the book. It's about the victims, what they went through and what they continue to go through. And that's what we're trying to get the word out.
It's about. It's about justice.
Right.
This is about justice for these people that have been harmed, that have been persecuted, that have been abused, that have, you know, this is a story about justice. And, you know, I'm so grateful that you guys used, you know, your platform and to give these victims a voice and wrote this book to give them a voice. You know, I just kind of want to step back a little bit and have a broader conversation about, you know, the church and how this happened, because, you know, everybody on this earth is looking for spirituality, right? Be it through organized religion or, for me, a more secular belief in a power greater than myself. You know, as human beings, we yearn for connection and belonging. And this, to me, is what makes these religious cults like the Word of Faith Fellowship so dangerous, because they are taking advantage of and prying on people's basic desire for love, connection, and community. They are, in essence, weaponizing a human being's belief system against themselves. They are weaponizing religion. They are weaponizing faith, things that are supposed to be sacred and right.
Yeah, you know, I think you said it well. A lot of the people that went there were flawed, and they were looking for that spirituality. They were looking for that help to get off, you know, drugs, to get off alcohol, to, you know, have a good relationship. And they were, you know, to a certain degree, and this goes back to the very beginning of our conversation, one of the things that separated Jane Whaley from other, you know, in the evangelical community was she was an older woman in a male-dominated, you know, profession. And so she would appeal, you know, she started in her 40s, and she would appeal to these women who were in their early 20s, who were going through emotional, you know, traumas in their life. Maybe they were, you know, physically abused, sexually abused. And she took advantage of them. You know, she came across as this motherly figure. And that was one way that she got people in and took advantage of them.
Right. You know, there also seems to be a strong denial period for people who get pulled into these cults. Where does this denial come from? And how do the people you interviewed in the book break through the denial of kind of what's really happening?
Well, it just takes them time. You have to imagine when people come out of the Word of Faith Fellowship, especially the ones who were born there or went there as kids, they are lost in the world. For example, Jamie Anderson is in the book. He left when he was 18, you know, left his family behind. He had gotten a little inheritance. He wanted to go to law school. So he drives up to UNC and says, hey, I'm here to apply for law school. And hey, there's like, okay, well, go home and get your computer and fill out application. He just did not know practical things. And they feel extremely isolated. You know, here you have this 18-year-old kid in college. He's trying to make friends. He's hanging out with people. They might be riding a car, singing along to a song. He doesn't know the word. They talk about a movie. He doesn't know anything about it. So it just takes them time to deprogram, in a sense.
Yeah.
They have to learn these things. You know, they have to make friends and see what normal relationships are supposed to be like.
Right. You know, and
that's a lot of hard work to kind of relearn your entire, well, to learn what you should have learned during your entire teenage years. Just, you know, the basics of communicating with other people that I can't imagine what these people have to go through.
They have lifelong scars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, are the people you interviewed for the book that got away from the church, what is their life like now? I mean, I imagine, like you're saying, that there's a transition period, you know, and a healing period to reacclimate to normal life. But, you know, have they been able to? You know, how are they doing?
It varies. You know, John David Cooper, who kind of opens the book, he's doing really well. You know, he was married to someone in an arranged marriage in the church. His marriage did not work out. They're both out of the church now, but they're not together anymore. But, you know, he's done well. He's a doctor. Some of them have become lawyers. Others struggle more. You know, you'll see in the end of the book, we talked to one guy, and I commonly ask people, you know, do you still believe in God? And often they say no. And this one guy volunteered. Matter of fact, I had the Bible when I left, and I brought it with me, but all that's left is the cover now because I've used the pages to roll joints.
Good for him.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, that's what he thinks it's appropriate for. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right, so that my point in saying that is, you know, there's various levels.
Yeah.
Some of them have done well, and some of them really struggle. You know, Michael Lowry, he's at times been homeless and addicted to drugs, mm-hmm. so a lot of them have some really, you know, deep scars.
With some of the abuse that some of these people have taken, I'm surprised that more aren't, like, you know, on the streets and not able to cope in society.
Well, even the ones who, you know, have found, like, success in business or law practices, they still struggle.
Yeah.
They have nightmares. You know, this is a lot of them still have family members in the church. You know, Jamie Anderson, we talk about in the book, the closest male person to him in his life was his grandfather.
Yeah.
And his grandfather was in the church, and when he died, not only would they not let him come to his grandfather's funeral, they omitted him from the obituary.
Mm.
And that's what a lot of these people say is that, you know, I can take my parents calling me a liar or my siblings calling me a liar, but really, what really hurts is when they tell you, you're dead to me, you don't exist anymore.
Mm.
I mean, think about that, being told by your family, you're non-existent.
Right.
It really hurts these folks.
Well, you know, they're free, but they're free. You know, that's, you know, the freedom came with a cost, right? Because they broke free from, you know, this cult. And so family members who are still in there, you know, they're programmed. Like, let's be real, right? They're programmed. And, you know, I think what's interesting to me about this story is that every single human being on this planet is looking for something to believe in, right? And like I said earlier, whether that's religion or spirituality or whatever that is, you know, we all want to believe in something bigger. It's what guides us, you know, on this earth, and it's what connects us. And I think that, you know, as these people who break free from this cult, you know, I think it's important to just know, it's like, look, I'm still on my journey of faith, and I'm still looking for what my spiritual, and still defining my spirituality. You know, some days it's the ocean, some days it's, you know, the sky, or, you know, the great outdoors. And, you know, my faith is much more open now than it was when I was born in my church, you know, because when I left, it was like, okay, if you don't have a place for me here and you're not going to accept me for who I am, then I'm just going to go find my own acceptance. You know, I had to, you know, kind of, you know, I was raised in a world where it was like, love is heteronormative. Like, I had to get married to a woman because that's what my dad wanted, you know, and all that, those kind of things. And so I had to kind of unlearn everything I was told and discover who I am. You know, so I hope that, you know, as these people keep breaking free from the church, that they get to have that discovery process that we all get to have in our lives, right? That sometimes these religions can block us, especially these dangerous ones. They can block our advancement and our development and our spiritual and emotional and mental journeys.
Yeah. They're trying. They're trying so hard. And, you know, just like anyone who's experienced any kind of traumatic experience, it comes back without warning. Mm-hmm. There'll be a trigger and boom, and they're back inside the church, you know, mentally. And it is just, you know, so difficult. And one of the reasons, I think this is important, Ryan, one of the reasons that, you know, they started talking to us, because really, I going back to the beginning, you know, it took months before, you know, months after the five people were indicted in 2014, for anyone to come forward. And the first person to come forward to talk to us was John David Cooper. And the reason he came forward, and a lot of the others came forward after, was because they wanted to protect the children. They said, this is still going on. And you know what? This is our way of doing something, by speaking out, to let those kids know that there's somebody outside fighting for them. And that, and for them, that's why they keep, you know, doing these things. That's why they, you know, talk to us for the book. And yeah, that's really important to remind people who are listening out there, there are kids in there and they're doing it for them.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I also understand that there are people who are still obviously in the church, who are giving testimonies right now online about the book, And about, you know, the victims who escaped, and basically saying that the book is a lie and that the victims are all lying. You know, this to me is the craziest part of all of this, that after all of this abuse, that these people would stay in this cult. And for me, it just speaks to that the power that cults can have over people, right? That, like, after everything, after they've watched their loved ones get hurt and watched the physical pain that is inflicted on them and on the people they love, that they still stay. And not just stay, they lie to the outside world to keep the cult protected.
They believe it's what God wants them to do.
Mm. Yeah. And for the victims, for the people who have left, that's really the toughest part. Mm. After the Associated Press ran a year's worth of stories, the radio station began renting airtime. And they have a show on three times a week, a half-hour show, where members come on to talk about just how, you know, wonderful the church is. But they've also produced these other videos where family members will say, well, you know, that guy who's out there, like Jamie Anderson, he's a liar. And they, for a lot of these victims, that's what hurts so much, is that the people inside are just calling them liars and won't have anything to do with them, and are trying to get the world to think, hey, everything is normal inside this place.
Right.
That really gets to them.
Yeah. You know, I kind of wanted to bring in politics, if you don't mind, just to kind of have a full circle conversation, because, you know, 74% of evangelical Christians support the current president of the United States. And there has been several evangelical pastors who have claimed that Donald Trump is the quote unquote chosen one who was sent by God to do great things. And, you know, this to me is where politics and religion, it kind of, it mixes in a way that I think can be dangerous, because presidents don't have a mandate from God or a mandate from a Christian church. Presidents have a mandate from the people that they're elected to govern. And when you start having, you know, pastors and, you know, evangelical pastors saying that a president is the chosen one, what starts to happen is, it's like, it doesn't matter, no matter how many laws the president breaks, no matter how many human rights abuses you have, no matter that there's children in cages at the border, no matter what human rights abuses are inflicted, they stick with him and they make excuses for him, right? Because he's the quote unquote chosen one, you know? So it's another level of just how, you know, this is why we have separation of church and state, right? This is why that, you know, this is what our founders were warning us against.
We can't speak to what other, you know, evangelical churches have done. We've seen the pictures of evangelicals, you know, praying for, you know, Trump in the Oval Office. We do know that, you know, there are members of this church that, you know, support Trump. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the New York Times did a story about Trump like 2 years ago, and randomly took a picture, and there were four members of Word of Faith Fellowship in the front row, mm-hmm. including Jane Whaley. So, and we know that they've actively, you know, campaigned for him. So, you know, why they support, you know, we can't address that. We don't know. But we do know that, you know, they have supported him, you know, since 2016.
Right. Well, and again, I mean, that just kind of goes to the, you know, this is, the right has done this now for a while, right? Where they've kind of weaponized evangelical Christianity. And it kind of, again, it blurs the lines, right? Between religion and politics, when, you know, it's important to remember that we have separation of church and state in our country. It just, I thought it was an interesting thing to bring up, because there just seems to be also a lot of overlap when you talk about Jane Whaley and some of her kind of manipulative and charismatic things. You know, I see a lot of that in Donald Trump as well. You know, that kind of charismatic, manipulative kind of, you know, and the stranglehold that he has over his followers, where, again, it doesn't matter how many times he lies to them, how many laws he breaks or how many violations he has.
The followers just keep coming
back
for more.
They just keep coming back for more. It doesn't matter. He can do anything, right? He could, like he said himself, he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and he still wouldn't lose any voters, you know? And it just, again, it, you know, it comes to this point in our country where I feel like our country, we have fragmented now, and we're all in these tribes. And it's so dangerous because, in essence, we're not left or right. We're Americans, right? We're all here. We're trying to build good lives for ourselves. And, you know, and meanwhile, while all this is going on, we got real problems in our country, you know, where people don't have health care and people are falling further and further behind, you know, on their rent. And, you know, we have economic inequality is at a 50-year high, you know, so we have massive levels of inequality. And yet we have a president who tells everyone, no, everything's great. Your life is perfect, you know, because of the stock market, even though half of America doesn't own stocks. So I just thought it was interesting because when I was reading the book, I see how, you know, if people are only getting news from a certain place or only hearing one person's perspective, their perspective on the world is very isolated.
Well, I want to bring up one point. The abuse began way before Donald Trump.
Oh, of course. Right.
And the institutions looking the other way also began, way before, you know, Donald Trump. This is just a complete failure of, you know, the institutions really, you know, to do their job and not protecting, you know, kids. So, I mean, that would be the only, you know, point that I would make about that.
Right. Who is this attorney? Like, can my listeners, can they petition that they reopen a hate crime investigation? Like, could they contact her office? Like, who is the federal attorney that would be responsible for bringing a hate crime case against the Word of Faith Fellowship Church?
The on the federal level, the people who would be responsible for investigating the church would be the U.S. Attorney's Office in Charlotte.
The U.S. Attorney's Office where?
In Charlotte?
In Charlotte.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the woman... who met with them, and again, one of the things that Matthew Fenner did and some of the advocates did was they began, you know, taping, you know, public officials because they didn't trust them to do the right thing, and, you know, they were right. So the assistant federal attorney who met with them is no longer in that office. However, he's been pushing, Matthew Fenner's been pushing for federal authorities, and Faith in America and other organizations have been pushing for years for federal authorities to look at the attacks as a hate crime.
Mm-hmm.
And so far, nothing. They've called, they've left letters, they sent registered letters. Nothing has happened.
Yep.
They've just ignored them.
Well, but these are one of those stories where nothing happens until there's enough public pressure, until there's enough public outcry. So if we can kind of, you know, use our megaphones, and I can use my megaphone to get more light onto this, you know, then they will take action. You know, unfortunately, that's just what happens, right? That sometimes our authorities don't act until the people rise up and say this level of injustice, you know, this level of hate crime is unacceptable to go on in the United States of America, you know, in a free nation, in a nation that's supposed to be democratic, that has institutions to protect, you know, ourselves. So, you know, that's just something that I thought about, you know, when I had you guys on the show, if we can, you know, just keep, you know, raising the megaphone so we can get authorities in there to help these children.
I totally agree with you on that, and so does Holbrook. I mean, when you listen to these tapes and you listen to the excuses that these authorities make about why they don't go in, it's appalling.
Yeah.
And you say to yourself, okay, well, if it happened in a different state, in a different community, wouldn't someone, there was a tiny cult in New York State, 2 years ago, where they killed one of the congregants, a teenage boy. Within, 3-4 months, they had shut down that entire cult, and they had charged some of the people in there with murder. Here, this has been going on for 40 years. Mm. People, they've just grown tired. They've looked the other way. There's been no help for the victims. And this is the case where you need outside people coming in, because we think the level of corruption in that county, and I would say part of that state, in North Carolina, is just too great. You need someone to come in and actually look and say, wow, we need to do X, Y, and Z.
Right. Okay. So people could write a letter, right, to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Charlotte to have them look into this case?
Sure.
Yeah.
Awesome. So everyone who's listening,
please do.
And I'll post the link for people to make it easier. All right. Well, we're getting close to the end here. I have my final question for you guys. What did you learn about yourself when writing this book? And what did you learn about America when writing this book?
Ooh.
Hmm.
to tough question. I mean, Mitch and I have worked together on some big stories over the years, but I've never had one affect me in this way because, you know, usually you go in, you write some stories, you hope there's change, and you move on. But it's been therapeutic, I think, in a way for a lot of these people to have someone listen to their problems and their stories. And, you know, we become friends with them. We talk to them often. And you want to see people do well. And, you know, when you care about people, it hurts you to see them hurting.
Yeah.
So it's kind of been an emotional ride. It really has. And, you know, as America's America. You know, you got the good and the bad. So for all the bad that went in that church, you know, you have people like Nancy Burnett, who's in our book. She was a guardian ad litem assigned to some foster kids who ended up with a family in that church. And after visiting the school and the church, she didn't think they should be there. So she made that recommendation. She was removed from the case. So she just decided to dedicate her life. Well, I don't even know that she made a decision to do it. She just started helping people. But that's the effect. She has really dedicated her life to helping these people. So, you know, for as much bad as out there, there's a lot of good, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good to remember that, too. You're absolutely right. Because sometimes we can get so caught up into because there is a lot of bad, but like you said, there's a duality. There is a lot of good, and we got to go where the good is too. How about you, Mitch? What'd you learn about yourself and about America in writing this book?
Well, you know, I grew up in the Bronx, and I grew up in a family where I was taught to question authority, and you know, I've done that, you know, for most of my career, but. And I've covered some, you know, again, you know, I have a Pulitzer in investigative journalism. And like Holbrook, it affected me just the level of corruption, how people who are in charge of protecting the most vulnerable aren't.
Yep.
And, you know, there's a line in the book, and maybe we can end it this way. So, you know, John David Cooper, you know, he made the phone call to me, which led to the investigation. Remember, we were working 4 months, boom. Nobody was calling us. They were all afraid. And then he, you know, called, and that started everything. So the line is, John David Cooper started this story with his telephone call. He knows he made the right decision. The end is near for Jane Whaley, he said. Like the others, he doesn't know how it will end. It has gone on for so long that many have lost hope. But John David Cooper is keeping the faith, believing that the good people will do the right thing and justice will come to Rutherford County, North Carolina. And so as depressing as this story is, you got to keep the faith that something will be done if good people come together and fight.
Absolutely. And that's that courage that he had to talk to you guys, right? And the courage that you guys had to write this book. You know, that's how we get justice in America. You have to have people who are courageous enough to get in the fight, you know, and to fight for it. Because unfortunately, justice doesn't happen unless we fight for it. What's the best way for our listeners to pick up your book?
It's available in many bookstores. They can buy it on Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Noble. All those ways.
Yeah.
Awesome. And how can they follow you on Twitter, on social media?
Well, I'm at Holbrook Moore, and Mitch is at Mitch S. Weiss.
All right.
Awesome. Yeah. And I'll make sure to tag you guys when I put the podcast up. Thank you so much for writing this book and for you know, shedding a light on these abuses committed. And you know, I will keep a thought out for you guys and for everyone that's been affected. You know, by this cult.
Ryan, thank you so much for, yeah, we do. And, you know, keep the faith for the victims. Mm-hmm. They keep fighting, you know, just like we are.
Absolutely. All right. Well, you guys have a good day now.
Thanks, you guys.
All right. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Whew.
Oh, yeah.
That was
deep.
That was deep. I hope everyone goes and picks up the book and
Broken Faith.
And I'm going to figure out how we can, I'm going to figure out how to contact the U.S. attorney in Charlotte so we can ask for her to pursue federal hate crime charges against this cult. I'll post that on my Twitter later today. Yeah. So I know most of you guys who listen to my podcast follow me on Twitter. So I'm going to post a link for that. Yeah. So
All right. And yeah, we just wanted to switch gears here and give you the latest news about a good friend of the podcast network, Bill Press. Bill Press no longer does his progressive morning show, but that doesn't mean he's gone away. He's out now with a great new podcast called the Bill Press Pod, and it drops twice a week. Check out the Bill Press Pod for Bill's interviews with some of the country's leading progressives like Maxine Waters, Mark Pocan, Jamie Raskin, all roasting Donald Trump, plus his lively end-of-the-week roundtable with three of Washington's top political reporters commenting on the latest craziness from the White House, Congress, and the 2020 Democratic primary. Now, for years, you know that Bill Press has been one of the leading progressive voices in the country, so I'm glad he's still out there on the left and stronger than ever. I encourage you to join me in subscribing to Bill's new podcast. Just go to wherever you get your podcast, search for the Bill Press Pod, click on subscribe, and you're in for a true progressive experience on the Bill Press Pod.
Nice. Yeah. I'm going to add that one to my list.
I've loved Bill forever. He's been a friend forever, and I'm glad he's still out there and giving us the truth.
Awesome. And you know, before we close out the show, we got to talk to you about Plexaderm.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big sponsors of our podcast. Yep. I've been using it for almost a year.
Yeah.
And you know, crow's feet gone.
Bags.
Under eye bags gone.
Dark circles gone.
Gone.
Yep.
Within 5 minutes, it's a rapid reduction serum. And if you want to try it, you can go to triplexiderm.com and use my code VOICES for 50% off a full-size bottle of Plexaderm plus an additional $10 off.
Whoa.
That's right, 50% off plus an extra $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code VOICES. Plexaderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexiderm.com today and use code VOICES at checkout. That's triplexiderm.com, code VOICES. Thanks for listening to an all-new episode of Amped Up with Proud Resistor. If you want to tweet about the show today, you can go to Twitter and use the hashtag Amped Up, and we'll catch you next week with an all-new episode. Have a great weekend. We got to talk to you about Plexaderm.
Mm-hmm.
One of the big sponsors of our podcast.
Yep.
I've been using it for almost a year.
Yeah.
And, you know, crow's feet, gone.
Bags.
Under eye bags, gone.
Dark circles, gone.
Gone.
Yep.
Within 5 minutes. It's a rapid reduction serum. And if you want to try it, you can go to triplexiderm.com and use my code VOICES for 50% off a full-size bottle of Plexaderm plus an additional $10 off.
Whoa.
That's right, 50% off plus an extra $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code VOICES. Plexaderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit triplexiderm.com today and use code VOICES at checkout. That's triplexiderm.com, code VOICES.